Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, this is Dana Callan, and you're listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview someone who I find extraordinary and who inspires me with their work and their approach to life. And today, oh my gosh, I am interviewing someone who I only met on TV, which means I didn't meet them at all. And her name's Gabrielle Etienne. And she was on High on the Hog, and there is a scene with her and her family, and I had to meet her and learn more. So welcome, Gabrielle. I'm so happy to be in Raleigh to get to see you in your home state, not quite your hometown because you're about 20 minutes outside.
Adjacent.
You're adjacent. Yeah. But welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here with you.
I feel that the place that you live is very magical to you and to your ancestors and your family. And I feel like to understand the place it is to you today, I'd love to go back and know what was it like when you were growing up? Because this is a place that you've returned to.
Yeah.
But you also went away from.
I feel like my neighborhood growing up, it was rural then. It was considered a lot more rural. I was outside. Most of my neighbors are my relatives. And so right next to me was my Uncle Ellis's house. And my Uncle Ellis's grandkids were my cousins, AJ and Dominique. And they were my ace spoons. And we used to just be outside every day. Okay, we were engineers. We made whatever we needed to make. We like played in the red dirt. We were outside kids, you know, like we picked the wild onions, which I still harvest now. We picked those and we would make our little fake food. It was just a beautiful, very safe bubble that I grew up in.
And has your family been in that place for a very long time?
Yes. On my mother's side, yes. They've been there for four generations. So my great-grandfather was the first one to kind of like get this parcel of land, which is, you know, this land is adjacent to land that my family's worked for a long, long time, right? We've always been in that area. They were farmers. They were tenant farmers. They were sharecroppers for a long time. And then they purchased this piece of land, this parcel. My great-grandfather used to run a juke joint right there on the property. I feel like it's so funny because this is a history that I've only discovered in the last like couple of years, right?
How did it come to light?
Something. Well, what's funny is like, just like all of this stuff that I'm working with now, or a lot of it, it's like just sitting down and having conversations, very casual conversations with my grandfather and his brothers, right? And so it'll just come up casually like, oh yeah, that's back when daddy used to run the joint. And it's like, wait, what'd you say?
Just amazing.
He just, and then turns out, you know, like with collecting some of the oral histories from like our community at large, like this was a spot. This wasn't just any juke joint. This was like the one.
There were lines.
There were lines. It was popping. It was packed. People were coming to eat. Apparently, like, you know, the shelves were always stocked with like pickled eggs and pig's feet. There was always something frying and popping and hot grease. There was always good music sometimes, you know, live music and records playing. And so like that energy, I believe, still lives in the soil where we are, right? And that's really like the well that I pull from whenever I host anything, especially on our property. It's like I have this beautiful, rich history of generations of entertainers and also like just placemakers.
So Who do you think made all the food?
Oh, so it was a joint effort, right? Okay. I've heard a few different stories, but I know my great-grandfather was known for his barbecue.
Okay.
And so he was the one who people would come from Raleigh, they would come from Chapel Hill, wherever they were, they would bring him their whole hog, and he would pit cook it. And then he had his own sauce that was like, it's so funny because this sauce is still talked about by people. I never met my great-grandfather, but I feel like I knew him because I've had people come up to me at funerals and be like, you know, your great-granddaddy shared his sauce recipe with me. And I'm like, ma'am, I don't know you. I was just, you know, trying to mind my business. But it's really cool because I don't have to pull from far, or, you know, it's like it's right there and I see it manifesting in the way that my grandfather prepares his turkey barbecue. He still makes my great grandfather's sauce. So he's the one.
So you have the recipe somewhere.
Oh, yeah. The recipe is there. I'll never share the exact recipe.
All right.
But I do my own
version
of it.
Sounds like he was very generous, however, in sharing the recipe.
You know what?
Unlike you.
I love him. I like you.
You're just going to keep it tight.
No, I have a version of it
okay.
that I will freely and happily share.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you grew up in this place that is so extraordinary, and you left. Mm-hmm. You went to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. You came to New York. What made you think that leaving was a good idea? And what were you searching for?
Well, I thought leaving was the only option since I was a little girl. My mom is an actress. And okay. so I grew up in the theater. I grew up watching her like build these incredible worlds on stage. And I've always been, I was a theater kid. Like I loved, you know, when I went to school, I studied communications and film and loved my theater classes and my improv classes because I love storytelling. And the stories that my mom was telling me since I was a kid and my grandmother were like stories of other places outside of where we're from. And so it's funny because my mom got to go to Europe when she was a young woman for singing. And she went on this trip. And I mean, you would think my mom lived in Europe for like years, the way she talks about it. I think it was probably like 2 weeks or something. She had like a host family. But the way that she talks about it, you would think like, my mom grew up in Paris. Yes. And so I've always like wanted to go out and explore these places because of the way that it was talked about at home and the way that like my mom never limited me. She never like put me in a box, you know, whatever I wanted to do, however I wanted to show up. She really supported that. And so did my grandmother. And so I remember actually in moving back home, finding cookbooks on my grandmother's bookshelf. Hawaiian cookbooks, Japanese cookbooks, you know, like she.
Your mom brought back.
Yeah, like. My grandmother was like exploring. That was her way of getting out because my grandmother didn't get a chance to travel all over the world. But she
cooked a lot.
But she did love to cook. Yeah. And she was open to exploring and she really nurtured that for me. So I've always wanted to get out and see what else is out there.
So you went to see other parts of the world.
Yeah.
And it seems like some of your time in New York was really formative to what you're doing now, starting in fashion. You're dressed so exquisitely. It's a linen cream-colored jacket with black pinstripes and a sparkly pink sweater and like wide-leg torn jeans and the most amazing maroon high-heeled boots for a preservationist that I've ever seen.
Oh, God.
So you worked in fashion a bit in New York, which is why I did the detailed scene for the listeners.
Yes.
What did you get from New York that helped inspire you on the journey to go back home?
I feel like I gathered a lot of things. I think sometimes you have to step out of where you are to really understand the beauty and the worth and the wealth that you have access to. Living in New York, when you can have plants in pots, sure. I mean, you have to really acquire some wealth to have a nice lawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In New York.
Better to get a nice fire escape.
Right, yeah. Right. And get some pots and some plants. But yeah, it was definitely like a combination of things. So I was working with Chef J.J. Johnson when things really started to like develop for me. And I started to connect some dots between like the food that I was like storytelling around and doing research around with his work.
I read that you were like hosting dinner parties. Mm-hmm. And is that the sort of the research part, like cooking, hosting?
Oh, and what? Maybe for my personal life. Yes. Yes. Like cooking and hosting like dinner parties has always been like a joy of mine since I was a child, actually. Oh, yeah. That goes back to my 10-year-old self. But the work I was doing with Chef J.J. Johnson in particular was grain research work. And so I met Glenn Roberts at Anson Mills, and I met a lot of incredible people who were like in the fields doing the work, who we were sourcing the food from for his new rice concept or his grain concept.
Which is called Field Trip.
Field Trip, exactly.
Which is in Harlem.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was putting together, like all of these dots were connecting. I was reading Black Rice by Judith Carney. And there were just a lot of incredible resources that my world was open up to. And what was funny was at the heart of it was like some of the same stuff I knew was true for my grandfather and my great uncle who were keeping a garden at our home place. And so I was just connecting a lot of dots. I would go home during the summer. I would get out in the garden. I would come back with my suitcase full of veggies, collards, heirloom tomatoes. And that's where, like, the dinner parties really, like, came into play because I was like, I got to share these. I got to share these with my people. A lot of my friends in New York were actually from North Carolina. So it was kind of a form of, like, remembrance and, like, ooh, like, I miss these things. I miss stewed okra and tomatoes. So I'm going to make this, and I'm going to bake my fish in it, you know, and serve it family style. And that's really, like, how that came to be. But I was kind of, I think, feeding my homesickness by...
Did you feel homesick?
Yes, absolutely.
And surrounded yourself with people from home, food from home.
Come on. Yeah. It's like, girl, just go home. What are you doing? It really made sense for me. And I think, like, my grandfather, he's 86 now. When I moved home, I knew, like, okay, he's in his 80s. His brothers are in their, you know, 80s and 70s. I need to do this now if I'm going to do this. If I'm going to dedicate myself to, like, preserving these and archiving these stories, it's going to need to be now while the pieces still make sense.
Was there something that made you say, this is the time I need to go?
What's really wild is actually at this point, I try not to feel awkward about, like, admitting that I really just felt a calling. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it's hard to explain that to people, especially when you're like, you're working. I was working in the food industry. I was doing pretty well. Mm-hmm. I had just gotten a really cool job offer and was like climbing this ladder that I think on paper looked really good to me. And I think I also felt like, but the real work that you need to do is elsewhere. And so like a big part of this was I met Chef BJ Dennis, and went down to South Carolina and got a chance to spend some time with his family, his community. And it was such a mirror. And seeing him like doing what he was doing and archiving what he was archiving, it was like, okay, this could be a real thing. You know, it doesn't have to be so abstract. And so it was really beautiful having examples like him. Another one of my examples was Cornelia Bailey of Sapelo Island before she passed away. There are a lot of people who are doing this work, like this preservation work, in the place that they were from.
Amazing.
You know? Yeah. And so it was like, I'm going to just, I was what, 27? I was 20-something. It made sense then. It was like, I'm just going to uproot everything. I don't have a job lined up, but I'm going home. And I just got in the garden and did that like every day that I could and learned how to grow, learned how to make wine and pickle and preserve. I'm not a farmer. I don't consider myself actually a farmer. I consider myself a gardener. I keep seeds.
Okay.
And I work with farmers.
Okay. But I am curious. If it grows and you planted it, why are you not a farmer?
I think it has to do with because I've been so up close to the work that farmers are doing and the scale of production and the amount. It does.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel right. Like
it does because I've seen, like, they put the money, the time, all of what goes into them carrying that mantle in particular. It's a very specific thing. And I think at one point I didn't understand that. And so it's very like cavalier. I'm a farmer. Mm-hmm. I come from farmers, but I garden, you know, I keep my seeds. I, you know, try my best to like uphold the things that I've learned from my grandfather and his brother, my Uncle Andrew, who I work with, and my Uncle Herbert. And those are really important things. But yeah, I think gardening is a mantle on its own.
Gardening is amazing. And as is this seed saving, which we'll get to. So you came home, and I know that you're archiving family stories. And I'd love to hear some of them. I was really moved when I think it was one of your, it might have been Uncle Andrew, who made strawberry wine after having been moved from his house by eminent domain. And you're like, you know, things change, but they also stay the same. And I would just, I'd love to hear some of the traditions and some of the stories that you are excited about sharing with people.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the stories that I'm like most excited to share are absolutely like moments that I spent in that first year when I had first moved back home. And I was learning how to slaughter and clean a chicken and cook it and make chicken pastry, you know, how to salt mullet fish. That was one of the fish that we would preserve and salt every year. And then like used to like in a similar preparation to like bacala and like, you know, like make all types of stuff with, or just like boil it and then fry it in a skillet and eat it on a biscuit with some molasses in the morning. Wine making is a huge one, and Uncle Andrew is the one for wine making. And that's about like whatever is seasonal, whatever you're trying to preserve. So from plum wine to strawberry to muscadine, like we have all types of wine we've played with. And
I'm so curious about that. I mean, because you had shared a picture of like plums that weren't happy. You're going to harvest them and make the wine. The wine tradition must be time honored. So it's you pick, you press, into juice and then ferment? Like,
oh, yeah. So with the plums, we don't do any pressing.
You don't.
We pound.
Yeah. An amazing picture of you with a gigantic
stump.
It's like, what is that mortar and pestle thing? But it's not.
It's it's a stump. It's a portion of a branch of a tree, right? And it's been used from year to year. And so it's formed its own, you know, wild yeast. It's picked up things. It's its own living thing at this point. We always use that. And we use a big wash, you know, the big tin wash tubs to press the grapes or pound the fruit in. We add, we clean them in that, and then we press them. We pour them into barrels. We add water and yeast and sugar, and we leave them in the dark. And that's, I mean,
it's amazing.
It's really beautiful. I feel like because I love Italy, I love France, I love all the places that I feel like are held so highly in our industry. It was really rewarding for me to be able to come home and see that we have our own like traditions around like wine making and sausage making. And like what I love the most about like sausage making in particular is like it reminds you why community and like proximity was so important, because you needed your people to come and help you do this process. You couldn't do it on your own.
And what does the community help you do?
So it looks like 4 a.m. in the morning, you're slaughtering hogs, you're hanging them up to drain, you're butchering them and breaking them down. There is, for a family out in Roxborough where I go annually to their hog killings, I didn't make it out this year. I'm quite shame of myself. I was moving around too much. But their whole community and their family comes out, and it happens every weekend in December. And so it is, you know, as young as 10 years old to eight, up in their 80s, folks are out and they have a job, and it could be you're on the assembly line, mm-hmm. you're butchering, breaking down ribs and chops, mm-hmm. and you're sitting those things over here. We're breaking down fat. We're separating the fat for the sausage. And then the sausage is going over here as we move to a different place where it's going through the grinder with all the seasonings. Mm-hmm. And it's going in bags because they still make the traditional sack sausage, which is something you can't really find in any store. Have you had sack sausage?
Never. No, that's very cool.
I'm going to make sure I get you some sack sausage. It is such a treat. It's a cotton bag filled with this spicy pork sausage hung up, and the fat from the sausage just spills into the cotton and closes it like wax, and then it ages. It's so
okay,
delicious.
That's amazing.
I know. Okay, we'll talk after.
That's amazing.
And there's so many things like that. Do you feel like there's just so little of it, and that's why it's your moment to make sure that you record it and can continue? Or the opposite? Maybe it feels like it's all around you.
It is.
All around you.
Yeah. I think that was like the epiphany. I think coming into it, it was like, oh God, like which it is true. We're losing a lot of this stuff because the people who perform a lot of the acts are mm-hmm. aging out, mm-hmm. right, and transitioning on. But there are a lot of people from my generation who have been learning from these people for years. They're their fathers. They're their grandfathers. And so in the case of the family out in Roxborough, his two sons work and have been taking over for him.
Sweet.
And so those traditions won't be lost because there are people that find a lot of value in the coming together of folks around the actual food and then having access because that's their meat, you know, that's their pork chops, that's yeah. their ribs, that's their sausage yeah. for the year, which I think is just so beautiful.
Are there other ways in which people who follow these traditions, you included, live both inside and outside of the current day? To me, there's something that's so beautiful about a food way that's very old mm-hmm. when we spend so much of our time like on our phone and like what's the latest. And I personally am less and less interested in what's the latest,
yeah.
but I'm wondering how you think about that in your mind because you're very much in both worlds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like at the root of most of my cooking is like slow cooking and mm-hmm. slow food is central.
Does it translate to slow life?
I think sometimes, most times. Mm-hmm. I think I have a really unique setup mm-hmm. because I am so far removed. After leaving New York, mm-hmm. I am like at the home place. I'm renovating my home place. That has very much consumed a lot of my time. And you can't help but when you're tending a garden, mm-hmm. you can't help but like slow down. It will slow you down. And you can't be moving around a lot because your stuff will die. I have experienced that.
That's
also
awful. Yeah.
So yeah, I think I live in a really like I live in both of those spaces, but I prefer to be in the slow. Yeah. Give me the slow anytime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel that conflict? Like, because there must be calls on your time for all kinds of forward facing. I know you did a great Colors Festival in Tampa, mm-hmm. you know, to be called on as an expert. So you want to be able to fill that role, but you also want to be there. The colors are growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a balancing act. Yeah. Also still figuring it out. Mm-hmm. Also, I think like the last 2 years have been a big learning experience where I realized like, oh, I can put things, I can take those engagements and I can place them kind of at the top of my year, mm-hmm. you know, when things are still kind of dormant. Mm-hmm. And then when things slow down after the harvest season, I can also, you know, like I'm finding really creative ways to make it make sense.
You mentioned the home place, which I imagine started out with some cracks and the mechanical the tool shed or whatever, like.
Yeah, my grandfather's mechanic shop.
They seem to have so much, as you said, like so much life just in the ground. But also for me, looking at the before pictures, there's something just so special because it's someplace that just one doesn't ordinarily walk through that door visually, mm-hmm. you know? And I'd love to hear about being in this place. And then, as I understand it, your grandfather gave you the deed. So it is actually yours.
Yeah.
And what is that like to have that deed? And what are you in the process of, you know, doing in making it your own?
Well, let me tell you, this was the first year I ever paid taxes.
Wow. Yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah. Right. Teens come with responsibilities.
Don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and those Holly Springs taxes don't play. Mm. And it is what it is. But I think, like, there's been a really healthy helping of, like, responsibility and, like, love and joy and, like, grounding myself, which feels very necessary in this industry mm-hmm. because it's really easy to float away.
Mm-hmm. You have these... Well, it's at least one building, but it is the machine shop in the same...
Oh.
Tell me.
Okay. So it's around 3 acres of land.
Okay.
We've got the home place that sits there, which is the house I grew up in, yes. The house my mom grew up in.
Yes. And your aunt.
And my Aunt Kay, yes, who is incredible, who is also, like, she's one of the preservationists of our family. She's the one who taught me how to make chicken pastry the way that her mom made it, the way that her mom made it. But the shop, we've always called it the shop. It was my first job, essentially, because I used to answer phones in the house, and I would have to say, "Pop, what are repairs?" Like, I could never just, it doesn't matter if it was my friends calling. It doesn't matter. I was so embarrassed. I was on the clock if I was home. So I have a very, like, loving and intimate relationship with this building and with this history there. Yeah. But my grandfather... started this mechanic shop, like, in the late 60s, early 70s. And he employed a lot of the folks around us, right? A lot of our relatives, a lot of people who wanted to start businesses. He kind of acted as an incubator. The mm-hmm. space really supported a lot of other blooming entrepreneurs. And I always thought that was really cool because I look at the way that people honor and care for my grandfather. Mm-hmm. When his name comes up, when people mention Mayfield, like, oh, there is such an, like, people love him. Mm-hmm. And, yeah.
One of the things that I loved is how you talk about the tablescapes, mm-hmm. table settings,
yes.
as making a place. Mm-hmm. So it's a place at the table. Tell me about that.
So I love to refer to table setting as placemaking mm-hmm. because I feel like it's an opportunity to tell another story, mm-hmm. right? Like, something I love doing whenever I gather folks for food is mm-hmm. like, I love telling them where the food came from. Mm-hmm. I love mentioning, like, why they're eating what mm-hmm. they're eating. But also, like, I feel like the table tells its own story mm-hmm. and it's an opportunity to, like, call people into the space who maybe couldn't physically be there. And so, much like an altar, mm-hmm. I treat like the center of my table as a place to, like, put portraits of my ancestors and my elders who I honor, love, and respect, mm-hmm. put dried flowers and plants that I've foraged mm-hmm. that also tell a story of the seasons. Mm-hmm. And it's also, like, an opportunity. I don't always encourage folks to, like, take a little something. But, you know, I put seed heads on the table a lot of the time. And it's something you can kind of take with you and plant on your own. So I love an opportunity to, like, tell another story, mention some names without necessarily mentioning all the names. Mm-hmm. And also, like, just create a beautiful space for us to, like, enjoy one another. I feel like that's, like, when your table setting is warm, mm-hmm. it creates a tone, just like the music, just like the food, all of that matters.
And I've seen you use pottery that are made by potters who you love. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes to every single thing on your table.
Everything is placed with intention, and I feel like you feel that when you sit down. You can feel the intention. The books, you know, I have Nikki Finney, Occasional Poetry, her mm-hmm. hotbed book that she released, always is on the table. Huh. I always have, like, some Edna Lewis. I always have, there are a few folks who I always like in the space.
Love that.
And I hope, you know, you'll pick up a book if you have a moment and just kind of, like, look at it, gaze at it, see some pictures, and it'll take you deeper into the story.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
We haven't talked too much about food, which is sort of funny, because your food is amazing. What's the things that you like making the most?
Well,
or tell your story the best? I mean, I'm imagining those two things might go together.
Yeah. I feel like just eating and cooking seasonally. Like, what's coming out? What's fresh? What's available? I feel like I love getting gifts of like, hey, I raised and cured this bacon. Those are the
you get much better
things.
Gifts than I do. I'm
like, but yeah, I love stuff like that. It really does like inform what I'm sharing with others. It's like, what am I able to right now? It's like creasy season. So I don't know if you know what creasy greens are.
I do not. Tell me.
It's a wild green. It's it's also referred to as upland cress. Okay. It's a peppery, almost like arugula wild green that grows everywhere. And it's one of those greens that was used historically to cleanse. It was a tonic green. So at the top of the year when it's growing, you're eating it because it's cleansing your system. It's like also poke salad was another one of those greens. That you have to, of course, cook first before, you know.
Not of course to me. Good to know. Otherwise, I'm going to be getting that poke from the market and going, just chewing on my poke here.
We don't want that for you.
No, okay.
There are a lot of, like, things that, like, you have to know the story. You have to know the tradition in order to eat it properly and not get sick. Yeah. I love, like, going out into the woods and that being a part of also what informs my menu. What's blooming, the red buds, you know, the peach blossoms right now. Like, all of those things are informing my menu. I'm using a lot of tea these days. I'm using a lot of, like, unconventional braising liquids.
I was reading about how you're trying to find a way to make the perfect hot link that you actually would eat and not be like, oh, my God, I just poisoned myself.
Yeah.
Are there a few things like that where you're thinking about, I know it's made with, like, a horrible dye in the past, but I'd like, or whatever. But you'd like to find a way to bring it into today?
You know, some nostalgic things I just let be.
Okay.
Yeah, I just let them be what they are, and I only eat them when I, every blue moon, because I don't want that in my system all the time.
Yeah.
Now, red hots are something that I grew up eating, and I absolutely believe.
What did I call it? It's a red hot. Sorry. Yeah.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
Red hots are delicious, okay? But I also believe there are better ways to get to a red link. And so I enjoy playing with that stuff because, you know, I got really close. I'm picking that project back up this summer. I'm going to try and do something before Juneteenth. But, it makes me feel better when I know what I'm eating is, like, reasonable.
Yes.
You know,
for sure.
No one was insulted by the way that this animal was raised or assaulted by the way that it was raised. And also, like, the redness of this dog is because of the ancioli paste or the paprika or, you know, that's my goal.
Yeah. So seed keeping as part of keeping history, part of legacy. Can you tell me, you know, what are your interests in seeds and what should we all be thinking about with seeds?
Honestly, my view on seeds has really changed a lot since I first got out in the garden. I think I was always like heirloom. You know, because I think that's what we're kind of like trained to understand. Which I think is beautiful because heirloom seeds, to me, the beauty in them is they tell a story of a place. Mm-hmm. They tell a story of a soil and mm-hmm. of a family, usually, mm-hmm. that raised and kept mm-hmm. those seeds for a long time. So I think that's beautiful. And I think with my own gardening practices, like land-raised gardening has been really fun for me because you get to kind of allow things to thrive that will thrive in your soil specifically, mm-hmm. right? So it's kind of promiscuous mm-hmm. pollination. Mm. So you plant a bunch of stuff around itself, like, you know, together, and you see what thrives, and you cull out what doesn't do as well, and you allow whatever did the best mm-hmm. and crossed over. You keep those seeds, and then you continue to grow that out.
Got it.
And so I feel like that has worked really well for me, and I'm excited to play some more with that. Mm-hmm. But I also love, I mean, I love the story of an heirloom, and I work with the Heirloom Collar Project, which I think is really cool because, you know, there's over 70 varieties of heirloom collards.
Wow.
And each of them have their own unique, beautiful taste. And mm-hmm. so for someone like me who is like a pot liquor connoisseur, I'm just in heaven with that information.
Yeah, that goes on the, we don't use business cards anymore, but that's the IG handle.
Yeah,
pot liquor connoisseur.
I like that.
Yeah,
actually.
For sure. I mean, it seems fair to me, for you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I have a little seed bank that I keep that has, I haven't counted my seeds, but I know well over 200
wow.
types of seeds.
Wow.
A lot were gifts. Mm-hmm. Some were shopped. Mm-hmm. My new obsession is Ujamaa Seed Collective.
And tell me about that.
Oh, my God. They specialize in, like, seeds of the African diaspora. Mm-hmm. So I was able to get a lot of, like, African greens, mm-hmm. Peanuts, that type of stuff, grains from
legumes.
Them.
Uh-huh.
But they also, like, they have some other, like, they have some wild things. They have some indigenous. So if I'm going to buy seeds, I try and get them from, like, collectives and groups like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get a lot of seed gifts, which I always welcome.
Mm-hmm.
And then from time to time, like, there's always, like, a seed exchange or something going on.
Yes. You came into my consciousness through High on the Hog. What was that experience like for you?
I loved it. I was, number one, the team, the crew that they had mm-hmm. just really made me feel at home. Mm-hmm. I was literally at home.
Yes.
But they made me feel so loved, and like I was the best thing in the world that they had ever seen. But yeah, it was a really beautiful experience. And initially, they just wanted me to be a part of BJ's segment. I was uh-huh. supposed to come to South Carolina and be a part of that, which I did shoot in South Carolina. But when one of the producers talked to me about like what I was doing, the work I was doing at my home place, mm-hmm. they were like, oh no, we gotta. This needs to be a whole segment. And so they ended up coming out, and like, I was like, okay, I guess I'm creating a dinner. So I kind of recreated a dinner just for that episode, but it was kind of a very small, tamped down version of my annual Equinox Supper, which is something that I do every September.
The last one, or the one that I know about, was a tribute to the rural imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about, what is the rural imagination
Ooh.
To you?
Oh, it's everything. It's everything. It's my grandfather engineering and making things using what he has access to. It's very much like that as an ethos, right? Like, what do we have access to? What is seasonal? What's available? And we're going to use it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to share it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like gardening, too, is like witnessing a seed turn into a crop. It's, you know, seed back out, watching that process, like, sparks my rural imagination. Mm-hmm. I think it's, like, all the beauty of, like, the access to land and trees mm-hmm. and just being able to spend time with land and trees. Like, it really is everything.
I love the way that you have your own definition of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to share that? Like, how do you think about wealth?
Wealth, for me, is, like, the ways that you're able to, like, care for yourself and your family. And through food sovereignty, specifically, I feel like we've been able to reimagine what wealth looks like for generations. So right now, for me as a creative and as an artist, like, wealth really looks like having access to, of course, like growing my own food, having access to like farmers that grow this beautiful food, and then also like being able to like make from whatever is around me. And so like the freedom to have a textile project. I'm working with a friend of mine.
Are you dying with mud?
Of course I am.
That was so amazing.
Of course I was dying just like, wow. With red clay.
Red clay, sorry.
Yes, red dirt.
It's beautiful.
Yes, it's like, it's what are the things that we've been using for generations as medicine, as clothing, as, you know, as food. It's really like just accessing those in new ways and like playing with that stuff. It's really been fun for me.
Another project that you have going on is the Tall Grass Food. I'd love to hear about what's happening with that.
Yes. So Tall Grass is a CSA, which stands for Community Supported Agriculture. It's a CSA model that we work with Black farmers all over the state to source fresh food biweekly. We feed around 250 families. And you can come and pick up a box that has around 8 items, fresh eggs, whatever is coming out of the earth that week. It's been harvested maybe a day before you get it, so it's the freshest of the fresh. And it's from our community of beautiful growers and farmers here in the state. So it's just a celebration of like Black food and Black food history. And we're actually transitioning it from a CSA model to a cooperative. So we're working now with the farmers to try and figure out how we can hand it back over to them. You know, we've built this kind of platform and we've got a beautiful base of customers who are like excited about the produce, and now they're going to be getting it directly from the farmers. And we're just figuring out what that looks like this season.
At the end of each show, I ask my guest if there's a woman that they admire, who they want to give a shout out broadly to, who deserves more attention.
I was just down in Charleston for
Charleston Wine and Food.
So at Chef BJ's event, he did like an excursion, and we went out into the rice fields. Mr. Chalmers and his wife, they grow rice out there, and it was such a beautiful experience to see the fields, to learn directly from him, like what he's been doing and what his family, really, he's generations deep in that work. At his event, I met Ms. Valerie Irwin.
Oh, love her. She's amazing.
Miss Valerie Irwin.
Geechee Girl.
Geechee Girl Cafe.
And she's amazing.
She is absolutely amazing. I was like, give this woman her flowers right now. Number one, her energy is everything. She's incredibly talented. The food she served us was beautiful and delicious. And she's just thoughtful. And you could tell, like, she was cooking with her sisters. It was just so beautiful to see, like, what she's manifesting. Miss Sally Ann Robinson is another woman who, she is on Dufusky Island. She is also doing cultural preservation work through food. She was on the episode with me, actually. Oh. So when we went to South Carolina for the Whole Hog, it was on her property.
Got it.
So Miss Sally Ann, absolutely, like, superstar, incredible, makes you feel loved. Her food, everything I tasted from her was delicious and felt like home. And so she's definitely another one.
Well, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure to have you on Speaking Broadly. Thank you for joining me in the studio.
Thank you.
Gabrielle, so happy to meet you. And for all of you listeners out there, I hope you enjoyed the pod. And you'll listen in again next time, bringing more amazing stories from incredible, inspiring people. Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This show is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.